2 and a top of 21. For the mid-north coastal waters, Woolite to Seal Rocks and 60 nautical miles seawards until midnight tonight. South to south-westerly winds 10 to 15 knots, reaching 15 to 20 knots in the north. 1 to 1.5 metre seas and a southerly swell to south-easterly about 1.5 metres. Coming up very soon, I'll be talking to Lewis Tillett and continuing the music journey. Just before I do, I'm going to play a track from the album that we're going to be discussing today. And the album is Cry Against the Faith. And the track is In Loving Memory of...
Thank you.
In Loving Memory Of was the name of that track from Lewis Tillett. It's the album Cry Against the Faith, released in 1998. Lewis joins me now to continue the tumultuous journey of his music and his life. Thank you once again for being here and taking us on the journey, Lewis.
It's my pleasure once again, Irene.
Right, so you've actually had a bit of a long trip today, have you? Been driving most of the morning.
Yes, yeah, I've come up from, from near Cooma up through the Brindabella Ranges.
Wow.
Stopped in at the old Honeysuckle Creek tracking station where they first, visions of Neil Armstrong landing on the
on
the moon were relayed to Australia. And there's nothing but concrete slabs there. But then went across to Tidbinbilla, and it was funny looking at the not many people seem to realise just how touch and go that whole thing was. That looking at the ECGs, they've got printouts of the two pilots, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong.
Yeah.
And because they had three onboard computers, and two of them failed once they decided they'd be on the point of no return.
Right.
Then the place where they were meant to land was no good. And then Neil Armstrong decided to fly the machine manually, a machine that had never been flown before in space, in an environment, and his graph is just completely consistent, and Buzz Aldrin, who was sitting next to him, is just a black morass of zigzags, and they landed literally with only seconds of fuel, otherwise they'd still be up there.
Goodness me. Oh, well, there you go. A little bit of history there.
Mm.
Okay, so the last song I played was In Loving Memory Of. Who or what was it in loving memory of?
Well, I think I mentioned previously that I'd got to a stage where I threw away my phone book. It became almost like a roll call of the dead.
Mm.
In some ways, this is an eulogy to all of those people. It's also an eulogy towards lost dreams, lost false expectations in life, romantic ideals that were, rapidly becoming buried in this great miasma of chaos in my mind. Yet it's, even though they may have seemed like dreams that were false and had no foundations in reality, the dreams were dreams that inspired me to keep going. So it was it's in reference to no one or nothing in particular, but the fact that even if they were just dreams, they were real to me, and that's what inspired me to continue with my journey.
Beautiful track, absolutely beautiful track.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And hence the fact that it's an instrumental.
Yes.
Because I attempted to write lyrics to it and thought, no, lyrics are going to diminish the almost ethereal nature of the message.
Yeah. Now, when we spoke about your previous album last week, Midnight Rain, released in 1995, you were in Greece. It's now 1998, and you're 39 years old. Where were you in your life journey then?
I'd been trying again desperately to get release this album in Australia. I'd waited for well over a year, was eventually told there is absolutely no interest in your music anywhere and we cannot find anyone to put it out, the Germans and the Greeks. Then I said, well, how about I try and find someone to put it out, to the person who was supposedly my manager, and called the Germans and the Greeks, and they put it out straight away. So, some time ago, I think I talked about almost like a schism between my perception of being in Australia and musically and ideologically and European. Now the schism had turned into somewhat of a diaspora. I was Australian in name only, and the music, I wouldn't exactly say a musical refugee, but I'm not interested in ramming things down people's throats, and if people are interested in listening to it, that's where I'll go to play.
It's quite incredible, though, isn't it? But it's not the first time we've heard that that story, is it?
No, and it's the way it's pretty much always been, and yeah. I've no doubt will continue to be.
That's right. Now, for those that have been following this journey, you will know that Lewis was battling alcoholism, probably exacerbated by an undiagnosed mental illness for many years. And as we discovered last week, you not only endured extreme turmoil with your mental state, but you also suffered to the point of near death with some serious physical injuries.
Yes, there's been more near deaths than I even know about. I mean, I was at this stage quite literally living on the street, wandering around, if you know Sydney, William Street.
Yes, I know it.
and befriended and in the most generosity of spirit by a lot of desperados, street people, mostly the prostitutes who used to inhabit the squats there. I would stagger back after a performance, couldn't even find keys into how to get in, work out how to undo the lock. They would make sure that I got in, take me up to a room and make sure that I was safely in bed, leave the keys on the bedside table and lock the door behind me to make sure that I was safe. So, it really was a hellish state, and strangely, I'd actually do a performance, and at the end of it, I would say, "Is it to the audience? Is there anyone who has a storeroom or a spare couch or something like that?" And people would laugh; they thought I was joking,
yes,
and it was dismissed as a joke, and it was no joke.
Goodness me, it certainly wasn't. Right. Now, as we've chatted over the last 6 weeks, it's six weeks today, by the way.
Yes.
So we're halfway through our journey, or your journey anyway. And I've listened to your story. There's a question that I would like to ask you. I mean, you don't have to answer it. But for many years, you really just made it at times through bouts of mental depression and alcohol-fueled sessions to try and ease your mental anguish. In all those times, did you ever actually set out to end it all?
It's a difficult question to answer. It seemed like the only way to put the fire out. I remember once answering that very question of saying, you know, to kill yourself, you'd have to be mad to do it, and I was mad. And certain things kept me going. I was extremely close on countless times. Other times, if you want to call it suicide, just wanting to go to sleep and not wanting to wake up and taking you know, tranquilizers and alcohol that should have killed people. There's some people have written books about it and you know, medical reports, and there was one thing that kept me. Now, one doesn't have to take either belief in an afterlife or not. It's irrelevant to this particular point that I'm making, because one has to try and understand that the state of mind that I was in was so profoundly disturbed that the time and space seemed to ceased to exist. So the concept of, you know, is there life after death or not, it was no longer relevant. I was in hell, and it was a hell that permeated every pore of my body and my psyche. And so this dreadful feeling that if I was physically to die, that I would stay there forever. And a little cliche actually helped me through a lot of those very desperate times when suicide. I mean, I was diagnosed as suicidal many times over,
right.
and told that my life was basically a daily proposition. I remember reading or being told, if you can't live in this world, what makes you think you can live in the next? And you know, these things need to be gone through. And I also remember being in hospital, and a fairly young psychiatric nurse, he took out all these files, if you like, of different patients, and they, a lot of them had quite a number of similarities to me. Even some of them vaguely looked like me. They're similar backgrounds, similar age, similar circumstances, and I thought this is a bit sort of odd. I thought this should be all confidential. And he said, "Do you see any comparison here, Lewis?" I said, "Well, I can see, you know, obvious ones." He said that, "Well, there's one really big thing, is that all of these people are all dead, and that's the way it's looking. So, yeah,
right.
What are we going to do about it?"
Goodness. So, would you say that most of your near-death experiences, but when you were close to death, were probably accidental rather than...
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Because there's suicide is something that is very much misunderstood. You know, it's sort of pretty hard to do a survey of dead people and say, "Why did you do it?" And but it is in my experience not so much to do with what is often bandied around as obvious things. You were depressed, or you were angry, you were trying to get back at someone, you were trying to seek attention, or you just couldn't handle it, you wanted to slip out the door. It is far more profound than that. The concept of suicide is there appears no other alternative, and my message is that there always is another alternative.
Yes.
And what one, you know, people will often try and present someone suffering with the facts. So well, look at the facts. Well, the facts, when you're in that, when one is in that state of mind, the reality is that you tend to focus on some of the facts, and the facts are the ones that are belting you over the head at that particular time. And the fact is that does pass, and even if it isn't, if something's belting you over the head, it's a lot easier to fixate on that than some intangible thing. I implore people to whoever feel at the end of the line like that, to make a sincere and concerted effort to try and find one good thing in their life, and they say there's nothing, and I'd say that is wrong thinking. And no matter, if you look hard enough and you just step back a little, you'll say, actually, maybe someone just did something nice for me
once,
and that should be enough to see you through that time, because it will pass.
Oh, that's wonderful. All right, well, getting back to the album that we're discussing, 1998, the album Cry Against the Faith, and the artwork on the album is rather out there, I'll say, for lack of a better description, as it is with a few of your albums. Does the artwork depict the content of the album?
Yes, the artwork's always extremely important to me. Every album that I've written has been an album as such, not a collection of songs. And images emerge. I don't complete an album and then ask someone to, can you create an artwork to suit that album? Something just seems to fit. And that actually, that particular picture, if you like, is based on a lino cut of a friend of mine, Lucy Child, who's an artist, and it was done during the time of the very first Gulf War, and it's of a mother in despair holding a sort of frightened baby, and the title "Cry Against the Faith." I mean, that's an old religious expression for anyone who goes against the mainstream. We can talk about all the politics of the Gulf War and, you know, economics and oil and all that sort of thing, but on face value of different ideologies and speak out against the faith, speak out against the mainstream, and a lot of suffering can come with that. But again, I would say that a lot of beauty comes with it, you know, and you know the thing that the you know the 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 hero dies once, but the coward dies 100 times a day for the rest of their life.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Right, okay. Now, the track we're going to close with today is Chained to the Stone from the album. So, any final comments?
Yeah, this was from a mysterious trip to Thailand. So mysterious that I barely know about it. I went to Thailand. I have a friend who used to actually run the venue that I played for many years in Sydney at the Sandringham Hotel, and it just about broke him. And he had a doctorate in English language, and had moved to Thailand, and I went over there on a whim. Got on the plane. Don't remember getting on the plane, and I'd left a message with him to meet me at the bar at Bangkok Airport, and whatever the hell that meant. And the bar that I waited for was inside immigration, and then the airport was just shut down. I thought, oh, he hasn't shown up. And then I walked through immigration. They'd shut everything down. There was no record of me being in the country. Then I walked out, and then I was on this insane, and it was insane. I decided that I wanted to meet Kum Sa. Kum Sa, who many people would... There may be someone who may remember, but the old days of the Golden Triangle, he was one of the big opium warlords up there, and owned private army and all that sort of thing. And I decided that I was off to meet Kum Sa. Walked in there, had a... I think a credit card with about $100 or $200, and somehow with that was enough to get me two bodyguards, a driver, and all this. And I travelled around like I was just king, almost in a blackout, and just saying, I have to see Kum Sa, and I'm off to see Kum Sa. I went all the way through from Bangkok, driving north up through Chiang Mai, then into Chiang Rai, then right up into the Golden Triangle. I have these vague memories of people in sort of paramilitary outfits and machine guns but I don't think I was so off the planet. They didn't know what they were dealing with, so I wasn't just some tosser who they said, well, let's just get rid of him, or just let's just ignore him, more likely. And I ended up meeting someone that may or may not have been Kum Sa, and ended up being given these gifts of these big chunks of what looked like quartz with vivid green, I think it's jade, through them, and they're given it as a gift. But the chain to the stone is, plays on words. I mean, that was the physical reality of this crazy trip. And also looking up at the mountains, seeing these big rock piles of rocks up on the mountains. Also, it was finding Kum Sa was almost like trying to find God in some strange way, because he was God to the hill tribesmen up there. And then being chained to the stone, of same being stoned, meaning being under the influence of alcohol or a drug or whatever, and not being able to break free from it. It's a big collage of all of these images.
What a hell of an experience. What a shame you can't remember it all so well.
Yeah, I can remember bits and pieces of it, but all I know is that back here in Australia, people were frantic because they were trying to find me. And there's no record in Thailand with immigration that I'd entered the country. The only way that I noticed that there's... I had it in my head that I had a gig in about 3 weeks, and that I had to get back in time for that. And then when I tried to leave the country, they said, there's no record of you being in the country. And I said, there must be. And I said, well, there isn't. And
so but you anyway, were 39 years old then?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I was... Goodness. It was an amazing trip, and no doubt a lot happened that I don't remember. But it was wild with a capital W.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a hell of a story to go out on. I like that one. All right, next week we're going to talk about an album, Live at the Basement, Lewis Tillett and the cast of Aspersions Band, right?
Yes, and that'll be a great one, because there was a TV documentary that was screened on the ABC.
Yes, I'd love to see that. You were going to give me a copy of that,
I'm still digging one up. I do have one.
Yeah, I'd love to have a look at that. All right, and that's 1999/2000 I've got, so anyway, we'll talk about that then. Right, thank you once again, Lewis. Good to see you.
Likewise, Irene, and it's always a pleasure, and I really wish that we had a lot longer that we could talk about these things. But something that I spoke to the man in the office about, technology, but I actually do have a website.
Yes.
And the only reason I mention that is not in any form of self-promotion, but it's got two things on it. One of them is, I believe it says, you click send a message to Lewis, and it will. You can email me. And there's another thing which I think is an outdated version of these, modern social networking things, but it's not a social networking. It's just called Yahoo Groups. So if anyone wants to chat amongst themselves, or if anyone wants to ask me something, it'd be fascinating for me, as well as maybe people that might like to speak amongst themselves. And the website is simply my name, which is Lewis, spell Louis. Tillett.com.
Fantastic. Well, that's easy to remember, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go out now with Chained to the Stone. And now you all know the story that goes with it. It's going to be fascinating to listen to. Okay. See you next week.
I'll see you then.